Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we continue our coverage of the workers' rights movement. This month is being called Striketober because so many strikes are happening across the country. Here is just a sample. 10,000 John Deere workers at 14 locations are on strike over pay and retirement benefits. John Deere CEO John May made $15.6 million last year. The company offered workers a $2 to $3 raise over the next 3 years. They also want to end the pension program for new hires. The UAW members at John Deere are on strike for the first time since 1986. Here is a clip from More Perfect Union.
We put in the hours, we make the product, and they are making billions of dollars on our back.
All these people have been in there during the whole COVID pandemic, coming to work every day, with the potential of exposing themselves and their families, to this, but they came in and worked anyway. Do I see Deere & Company, kind of recognizing that and trying to reciprocate in any sort of way? No, I don't.
John Deere makes $6 billion a year. They threw peanut shells on the floor and asked us to scoop them up. Well, guess what? My dad and me appeared this in 1986. We're back. We're union strong. We've got the community behind us.
That is a clip from More Perfect Union. Also, over the past 30 days, New York City cab drivers have camped outside of New York's City Hall, calling for debt relief accrued due to the cost of taxi medallions. A group of taxi drivers say that they had no choice but to begin a hunger strike this morning. Augustine Tang, a taxi driver who owes $490,000 on his medallion loan, told City and State New York, quote, "We've been shutting down bridges. We've been protesting outside City Hall. We're telling the city that this isn't an issue we can just let go. This is why we have to escalate it right now." Well, over the next couple of weeks, we will definitely cover the John Deere strike and the New York City hunger strike. Again, it's a hunger strike that started this morning. On today's Your Call, we're going to focus on the more than 30,000 Kaiser Permanente healthcare workers in California, Oregon, and Hawaii who have authorized a strike. Kellogg's workers in four states have been on strike since October 5th, and California garment workers have finally won the right to make an hourly wage and the state's minimum wage, which is $14 an hour. A majority of the 45,000 garment workers who work in California are currently only paid per piece, and some make as little as $3 to $5 an hour. After 2 years of organizing, California Governor Gavin Newsom recently signed the Garment Worker Protection Act. California is now the first state in the country to require an hourly wage for garment workers. Employers will be required to pay workers at least $14 an hour. Joining us now is Marissa Nuncio, director of the Garment Worker Center in Los Angeles, which organizes with garment workers in the fight for improved working conditions. Marissa has been an advocate for workers' rights for over 15 years. Hi, Marissa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Well, huge congratulations to you and everyone at the Garment Worker Center. We have had you on so many times over the past year and a half talking about this bill. You thought it was going to go through, and then it got tabled, and it was just disappointment after disappointment. So first off, what was it like for all of you when you found out that Governor Newsom actually signed the bill?
Yeah, well, it was, I think it really, it was a bit unreal for us at the beginning. We didn't quite believe it, you know. I think to begin, we expected, we sort of expected that it could take the governor the entire time that he has until his deadline, October 10th, to make his decision. He made his decision, I believe it was September 27th. We were also surprised at how quickly he made his decision, and it just took us a moment for it to all sink in. And then it was really beautiful. Our membership came together that evening. We just threw this big party together outside. and just celebrated. Just food and music and just celebrated. And there were so many tears. I mean, everybody was just moved that the organizing efforts were successful and everyone felt so proud.
Can you remind us of the organizing that you've all done over the last 2 years? I mean, a lot of these workers are immigrants, people of color. And as I said, when we did shows in the past, we learned that these are people who are making clothes for some of the top brands in the world, but they were making $3 to $5 an hour and then also dealing with COVID on top of that.
That's right. That's absolutely right. In LA County, the garment industry was the second worst impacted industry for COVID, with the most, you know, with the second most outbreaks. So workers were making our masks and getting sick, you know, and really at risk. But the reality is that even before the pandemic, this was a very dangerous and exploitative industry. And so workers had been really coming together for a couple of years to envision what could bring significant change in their industry. And they approached it from sort of a big picture level to, you know, an everyday on the factory floor level. And, you know, that is where they came up with the provisions of their bill. They said, we have to hold these brands accountable for wage theft in their supply chain. They're currently not accountable to us, even though we produce their clothing. And in the everyday sense, what we're, you know, what we really see driving our wage theft in the factory is this piece rate, is being paid pennies at a time. This is what workers always said, you know, nos pagan centavos. They pay us pennies at a time to earn our livelihood. And they said, we simply want to be paid minimum wage like other workers. And they proposed their bill. They found an author. They found co-authors. And this was meeting by meeting by meeting. They built a coalition of support amongst, organizations and trade unions. Again, you know, student groups, just meeting by meeting by meeting. And, you know, they waged their campaign in the middle of a pandemic, which was very daunting at first, you know, and they made the decision that they would really have to be creative in how they were telling their stories, how they were getting their story out, because they couldn't go to Sacramento, you know, they couldn't, gather, you know, in spaces. And so they, our members really underwent a lot of media training and storytelling training and used the media very aggressively, you know, just constantly. I mean, we lost count of how many interviews members did, but just really out there telling their story and using creative ways. You know, they use the heck out of Zoom. You know, every legislative visit was via Zoom, but they opened every single meeting, you know, with an elected to explain the garment industry to them. It was pretty powerful. You know, these are workers who can work up to an average of sometimes 14-hour days, but usually at least about 11 to 12 hours. And then they would do this work, right? They would, you know, come together in the evening to plan campaign activities. They would find a moment in their day where they could do a 10-minute interview. They were coming together on Zoom, you know, on the weekends, all after all of that work. But they were so committed. They were just so committed. And, you know, when, you know, I think it's just a significant example of when workers make the decision to organize and to see it through, the success that can come from it.
Marissa, every time we did a show about this, we heard from listeners who were shocked that massive companies like Forever 21, TJ Maxx, Ross were able to pay people in the state of California, the fifth largest economy in the world, $3 to $5 an hour because of the piece rate. So let's talk about how that's going to change. The garment workers will now be making at least the minimum wage, which is $14 an hour. How will that be enforced?
That's right. So beginning January 1st, the law will go into effect, employers will have to pay by the minimum wage instead of by the piece. So it just simply means, you know, for every hour worked, they have to pay the local minimum wage. In Los Angeles, it's $15 an hour, which is where the center of garment production is in California. Where there's a violation, say where the employer continues to pay on a piece rate, or does not pay the minimum wage, a worker then has the right to bring, they can do one of two things or both things. They can bring a wage claim forward to the state's labor commission and say, I'm not getting the minimum wage, or my employer is paying by the piece rate in violation of the law. They can also file a complaint with what's called the Bureau of Field Enforcement, and that can trigger an inspection, like a factory-wide inspection, where citations can be issued. If and in either of those cases, a worker can recover the unpaid wages. So if they, you know, were making only an average of $6 an hour, they can recover the $9 difference. And then there are also penalties that are attached to that. And, you know, so those are the mechanisms they have for it to be enforced. The other gain is that workers will now be able to successfully name the fashion brands that they were producing for in that factory and include them as defendants in their wage claims. And the brands will actually be on the hook. They'll be legally liable to repay any unpaid wages. You know, it's a hearing process. It's sort of like an informal kind of court process, but it is administrative. It's more informal, kind of easier to access. But there's a binding decision at the end of that. A hearing officer makes a binding decision and decides, you know, are wages owed or not? And if they're owed, the you know, again, the huge gain is that fashion brands will actually have to pay those wages back. They're legally liable just like the factory owner is. And that has not been the case for decades and decades, though fashion brands have been profiting off of these, you know, just abysmal wages. They've had no liability for it. So this is sweeping change that a worker can say, hey, you know, you're being enriched off of my labor. You should be responsible when I was not paid properly.
It's such a good point. For example, Ross Stores CEO Barbara Rentler brought in $18 million last year, according to execpay.org. So these brands' CEOs are making millions and millions of dollars in yearly pay compared to $3 to $5 for garment workers in California. That's going to change now. What you just said is really important because, when you know, when we did so many shows about the Rana Plaza devastating story out of Bangladesh, and then stories out of California, the brands will say that they outsource, and so they're not responsible for what happens in the supply chain. And it sounds like this law is really going to change that.
That's right, and that was the intent. That was absolutely the intent in the heart of our law, was to push, not only just to push the, you know, just practically speaking, that if a corporate entity is profiting off of someone's labor, that they should be responsible for you know, compensation for that labor. But really pushing back against the model of doing business that exists in the garment industry around the world. And that is the use of subcontracting to evade liability for labor costs, for working conditions. This is right, that around the world in the garment industry, multi-million and multi-billion dollar corporations will say, I'm not responsible for those workers. I contract for the production of my clothing. Well, you know, you know, that morally is unethical. And simply because it exists under law doesn't mean that it should, right? And that was the intent of this campaign, to change that law, to say, no, that is morally unethical. That is leading. It is actually causing and driving downward pressure on wages, and allowing workers to be exploited in this way, because fashion brands have all of the bargaining power in that supply chain. The suppliers want that contract with Forever 21 or Fashion Nova, you know, and they're going to accept a lower, you know, or they're going to offer a lower bid so they can get that contract, because they're competing with so many other suppliers. And they don't have control over that. They don't have control whether the fashion brand is going to give them that contract. And that creates this downward pressure, which really kind of enabled this lack of compliance with wages. And so the intent is, let's put, like, that cannot continue to be the case. We can say that that business model is wrong. We can say that that corporate greed is wrong, and we can push against it and demand something different. And that's really a movement in the anti-sweatshop, you know, movement as a whole. This is progress that is happening, where we're pushing back against that, what has been the sort of entrenched, you know, model.
So that raises a question of where do you think this will go? Because a number of people who worked so hard for this bill say that this is not a California only issue. We need to get this law passed across the country, and also just ensure that people around the world are paid a decent, livable wage and have a job with dignity. At the same time, you know, you've got the California Chamber of Commerce that put this bill on its job killer list. We know that the race to the bottom is continuing, just like you explained. So do you think that some of these major brands might take the production to another state or overseas so they don't have to comply with this law? Or do you think it will end up passing in other places?
Well, I guess to start to answer that question, there's a very, very real reason that brands produce in California, and in particular in Los Angeles. The majority of the clothing that's produced here is called fast fashion. It turns over very quickly. There's a lot of fashion seasons. There's a lot of new styles constantly going out to consumers. And for that reason, there is a production need to be local, to be able to get the goods, you know, get the products out to consumers on a regular and consistent basis. And that's what exists in California. And there's, you know, prominent access to ports, et cetera, in Los Angeles. So we often take that argument based on our history and based on what we see in the garment industry. We take that argument of job flight with a big, huge grain of salt, because we've seen that that's a lot of bluster more than reality. You know, the industry has been fairly stable locally for quite a while, since, you know, over, gosh, you know, a decade and more of major kind of trade changes in the industry, kind of trade law changes. Since then, it's kind of, you know, it's shaken out, and certainly for the past decade been fairly stable. So I want to say that we know there's a reason that folks are producing here. We've also seen this move towards what's called reshoring or nearshoring, where we have a lot of fashion designers and brands who say, I want the kind of added value of made in the USA or made in California, and I want to produce here, but I've wanted a level playing field. I've had to compete with sweatshops, right? And how can I thrive and stay afloat paying $15 an hour if there's a sweatshop down the street paying $5 an hour? Now that's not going to be the case. And so we've seen brands really saying, I want to stay here. I want to remain here. I just want that level playing field. And they endorse the bill for that reason. They put their business name to it. And then I will also say that I do think that there is a movement towards brand accountability in the garment industry. I think there's a movement towards due diligence in supply chain, same brands. You have to execute due diligence and ensure that your supply chain is operating above board. I mean, ensure, you know, invest in inspections, invest in sound business practices that ensure good wages and working conditions. And that's happening around the world. We see it in Germany. There's a provision that will be up before decision-making bodies in the EU. We see that just in private agreements around the world. And I do also think that all of the amazing strikes that are happening across the US are there's this powerful momentum of workers organizing and pushing back against those sort of that corporate power.
Well, again, Marissa, huge congratulations to you and all of the workers with the Garment Worker Center. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again for having us all of those times and helping us get out our message and for having me today. Thank you.
Thank you. Marissa Nuncio is director of the Garment Worker Center in Los Angeles. California is now the first state in the United States to require a minimum wage for garment workers. There are 45,000 garment workers in Los Angeles. Before this law passed, they were making $3 to $5 an hour. They will now make $15 an hour, which is the minimum wage in Los Angeles. But we should say that $15 an hour is about $31,000 a year. And we know it's very difficult to live on $31,000 in California. Still, it is a huge victory. And we will continue covering this issue to find out how it changes the lives of those workers. Now we are going to get an update on the more than 30,000 Kaiser Permanente workers in California, Oregon, and Hawaii who recently authorized a strike over a proposed two-tier wage system that would pay workers hired in the year 2023 26 to 39% less than current workers. Labor Notes reports that Kaiser is not hurting financially. Last year, it netted $6.4 billion and even returned $500 million in CARES Act funding to the federal government. Joining us now is Jane Carter, Director of Research, Public Policy, and Regulatory Affairs for United Nurses Association of California. They represent over 32,000 registered nurses and other healthcare professionals. Jane Carter is part of the union negotiating team. Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, based on what I've read, it is pretty uncommon for a hospital to embrace a two-tier wage system. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's pretty draconian in and of itself, actually. You know, two-tier systems really got its prominence back in the 1970s and really took off in the 80s and 90s. But it's important to note that those structures, those wage tiers, were primarily presented by companies that were in financial dire straits, where there was a lot of issues over profitability and in companies where labor is the highest cost of operations. To be very clear, Kaiser kind of dragged this out of the past to present this and claiming that the sky is falling, that they're going to face stiff competition in the future from companies like Uber and Amazon. But as you noted at the beginning, that is far from the case. Kaiser is not only financially thriving, to use their words, but very robust. You cited the $6.4 billion in net revenues last year. It's actually $2.2 billion solely on operations. That's just off of the membership and the return on the services that our members do at the front line every single day and in the middle of a pandemic. $2.2 billion is, what it comes down to, is $251,000 per hour and $6 million a day. It's how much they made the corporate executives line their coffers with in the middle of a pandemic. So it's one thing to have a company plead poor. It's another thing for them to say that they are in financial dire straits. It's another thing to want workers that were on the front lines in a pandemic looking at death 20 times a day and asking us to take wage cuts.
Wow. Oh, that's just devastating. To stick with the two-tier plan for a few more minutes, the same thing is happening with the John Deere workers and the Kellogg's workers. And they say that at the end of the day, when you're talking about a two-tier wage system, this is really about solidarity because they want their colleague to be able to feed their families like they can. They want their colleague, their new colleague, to also live with dignity. So can you tell us what you're hearing from healthcare workers, especially longtime healthcare workers at Kaiser, about why they have authorized a strike?
Absolutely. Look, two-tier system does create a second-class level of employees, of your colleagues. And when you're on the hospital floor, you know, you're in the middle of a pandemic. It was almost like a war zone, and you can't have that division. It divides the workforce in general, and it's not fair for the new employees coming in. We're facing a worker shortage across the country, but it's also really important to note that even Moody's in 2018 said that there would be a healthcare professional shortage looming, and that everyone should take notice. And just a few weeks ago, they issued another dire warning saying it's here, and companies are going to have to pay up for it. Look, to go from making a good wage, like our members do, we've got decent pensions, decent retirements, decent benefits, and decent pay, and then asking new employees coming in as early as 2023 to take a 26 to a 39% pay cut. That's not going to help the nurse shortage that we're facing as a country. In fact, it's going to exacerbate it even worse than it already is. I can't imagine a student nurse thinking they'd want to come work for a company like Kaiser, making 26 to 39% less than our current employees are making.
Tell us a little bit about what workers are facing right now at Kaiser. It is so incredibly difficult to get an appointment with a therapist. You know, usually you see a therapist once a week. I've read that if you're a Kaiser patient, you might have to wait 6 weeks. And then there's also major nursing staffing issues. Last month, we spoke with Zanae Triunfo-Cortez, president of the California Nurses Association, who's a nurse at Kaiser Permanente, South San Francisco. And she said hospital administration is prioritizing the bottom line over safe staffing and patient care. So can you tell us more about that?
I completely agree. Look, staffing was an issue before we even started negotiations 6 months ago. It has been an issue that we have tried to bring to the attention of corporate executives for months, if not years now. We've tried to work in partnership to address it. UNAC UHCP represents the rehab therapists in Northern California, and the proposals that we're looking at there are wage cuts. Essentially, the Kaiser has proposed to Red Circle about 10% of the rehab therapists in Northern California. Kaiser has also proposed a pension cut as well that would be pretty significant. Not encouraging for anybody currently working as a rehab therapist in Northern California, nor for any student therapist wanting to come on into the profession. But to be very specific, when we're talking about patients and quality care, our rehab therapists are extremely skilled. It is a profession. I call them a profession beyond a profession. They have multiple PhDs to tackle the issues that our patients need to tackle. They have to be highly qualified to do so. There's been an issue of managing the different referrals and the ability to meet the patient needs and not getting any support from management. Essentially, our therapists are not given the time to follow through with the appropriate treatment plans that they recommend for each patient, and it's clinically appropriate for each patient, and it's difficult to get in. So on top of everything else, Kaiser's these proposals aren't just impacting the pay and the benefits of our members, but really significantly and drastically impacting patient quality and patient care.
We have an email from Robert who says, can you explain how the heck Kaiser can label itself nonprofit while acting exactly like other for-profit health industry businesses?
I think that's a really great question. That really is. And I think the massive amounts of cash reserves also speaks to that. You know, I think it's great that Kaiser does have almost $50 billion in reserves, but that's literally 194 days of cash on hand. It means that they literally would not have to bring in a single penny for 194 days and still pay all of its bills. And they're still listed as a nonprofit. To be very clear, on top of that, if we took Kaiser's revenues solely and looked at just their balance sheet solely on their revenues and put them on the Fortune 500 companies that are not listed as nonprofits, Kaiser would be number 34 in front of Nike and Disney and Lockheed Martin. That's how much revenue and how profitable this company truly is.
So what is the time frame here? When will workers decide whether or not to go on strike?
Well, our Southern California, 21,000 Southern California healthcare professionals voted last week overwhelmingly to authorize the bargaining team to call a strike if necessary. And this coming week and next week, our rehab therapists and healthcare professionals in Northern California, as well as in Hawaii, will also do the same. And they will be voting on whether or not to authorize a strike. We are at the bargaining table today and the rest of this week, hopefully next week. And look, I don't think anyone in UNAC, UHCP, or in the Alliance Union of Healthcare Unions wants to be in this. We don't want to be on a strike. We don't want to have to be in this position. It's Kaiser's proposals and this complete line in the sand that has been drawn over wage cuts to both current and future employees, pension cuts to current and future employees that have put us in this position. If Kaiser cared so much about its patients, then they would actually be at the bargaining table and willing to have discussions on how to truly address patient care, staffing shortages, and employee recruitment and retention.
Jane Carter is Director of Research, Public Policy, and Regulatory Affairs for United Nurses Associations of California, Union of Healthcare Professionals. Jane Carter is part of the union negotiating team. Jane, thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
I really appreciate this. Thank you so much for taking the time to cover this really important issue.
Thank you. Well, coming up after a short break, we will get an update on the Kellogg strike. Workers in Nebraska, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee are currently striking over pay, benefits, and again, a two-tier wage system. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to get an update on what is happening with Kellogg's workers in Nebraska, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee. 1,400 workers at all of the cereal plants in those states have been on strike since October 5th over pay and benefits and the company's two-tier wage system. Kellogg's makes popular cereals like Corn Flakes, Fruit Loops, and Frosted Flakes. Joining us now is Maximilian Alvarez, editor-in-chief of the Real News Network and host of The Working People. It's a podcast about the jobs, dreams, and struggles of the working class. Hi, Maximilian. Thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me back on. And thanks for covering all these important struggles. That's why I love you guys' show.
Well, we love your show because you do the same. And Max, it seems like what's happening here is this two-tier wage system. John Deere workers are on strike over this. Kaiser Permanente workers might go on strike, and here we have Kellogg's workers who are up in arms about this two-tier wage system. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, it's important, right? Because, you know, I think that for most of our lifetimes, if the mainstream media even ever covered labor struggles, which it very often did not, it tended to cover them in a very bare bones light, basically training people to only understand worker struggles like these in the terms of wages and benefits and nothing else. And so a lot of us really haven't had a vocabulary to kind of understand what workers are fighting for right now. And so I think that makes it all the more important that folks are kind of learning that vocabulary and understanding and listening to workers themselves explain why that's such an important issue for them. You know, I would point folks to an interview that I did with Dan Osborne, who is the local 50G president of the union there in Omaha, Nebraska. That's the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers and Grain Millers International Union, or the BCTGM, representing the workers at Kellogg's who were on strike. They also represented the Nabisco workers who were on strike recently. But I remember at the Real News publishing this interview with Dan Osborne about the Kellogg strike. And he kind of walked through, you know, like why this two-tier system is such a problem. You know, I think that when we hear about the issues that workers at Kellogg's are facing, we tend to kind of focus on the immediately horrifying aspects of it, right? And you kind of already mentioned this in your intro, right? Kellogg's has reported a profit in 2020 of $1.25 billion. And cereal sales grew majorly over the course of the pandemic. This is another trend that we have been seeing that is part of these strikes, right? We saw it, I think last time I was on the show, we were talking about the Frito-Lay strike. Right. Same thing happened there, right? People staying home during the pandemic eat a lot more chips. And so actually, these companies have been seeing like record demand and have been raking in like huge profits. And all the while, workers have been sacrificing to make that possible. You know, workers who were once hailed as heroes for working through the pandemic and risking their lives and their families' lives to, you know, make cereal for the country, right? Or make chips for the country. Or workers at Heaven Hill Whiskey Distillery are on strike as well. And they've also seen like record demand for bourbon made in Kentucky. And so, you know, it really is significant that workers are kind of pointing out that what is underlying all of the strife is corporate greed, because Kellogg's workers, you know, to meet that record demand that they have been facing, have essentially been working, you know, between 12 and 16 hour shifts every single day for practically 7 days a week. You know, like there's a great report that we did at The Real News by the journalist Mel Burr from the picket line of the Kellogg's plant in Omaha, Nebraska, where one worker told her that the first day of the strike was the first day that that worker had had off since July. Mm-hmm. Right. So we're talking months on end of 12 to 16 hour days, weekends, holidays to meet that demand, while Kellogg's is bringing in these huge profits, and yet they refuse to budge on the issues that the union is talking about, which isn't even the long hours. Like you would think that that's what is making workers angry enough to hit the picket line. But what is actually kind of driving this strike here at Kellogg's is a real lesson in solidarity, right? It is the old timers and the longtime union workers who have a better pay and benefits package, really putting everything on the line with their coworkers who are making, you know, on average, like $10-$12 less than they're making. They don't get the same benefits package. They don't get the retirement that longtime union members have. This is what that two-tier wage system is. It's something that was created in the last bargaining round in 2015 because the company said that it needed to essentially create a second class of worker at its plants who that it could pay less, that it didn't have to pay certain benefits. But for all intents and purposes, these are people who are doing the exact same work as people next to them who are getting paid almost twice as much. And everyone realizes that that is incredibly unfair. It also sows a lot of division on the shop floor. It fosters resentment between workers. Mm-hmm. And so the unions really go into the mat to say that, like, look, this ever expanding group of lower paid, underprotected workers, you know, this is what Kellogg's wants its business model to be. It wants to essentially phase out the more expensive longtime union workers and create this sort of underpaid underclass of workers that it can, you know, keep hiring in and cycling out when they have nothing left to give.
Dan Osborne told you that 90% of the new hires in recent years have been Black men and women who make $12 an hour less than their, quote, legacy counterparts.
Right. I mean, like, you know, this is what the union means and what folks like Dan Osborne mean when they say they are fighting for their future, because they see where all of this is headed, right? They see that if they don't fight now, Kellogg's is going to keep going down this route, right? Companies like Kellogg's cannot help themselves. If they see a pathway to paying workers less, to protecting workers less, they will take it. They're not going to kind of opt for the more noble and respectful option out of the goodness of their own hearts. They're going to have to be forced to do the right thing. And that's what the union is doing right now. But we have examples of why this two-tier system is such a problem. I would point people first to another kind of common example which is GM, General Motors, which also implemented a two-tier system that it kind of was forced to accept. The union, the UAW, was forced to accept in the wake of the Great Recession because, as we know, the automotive industry in the United States was not doing so hot. It was there was threats that it could crater, and the government bailed it out and basically reopened contracts between the company and the union to impose this two-tier system that was supposed to be a temporary thing. It was supposed to be like, this is a belt tightening measure that will allow us to keep production up and stay afloat in these hard times. And, you know, to save those jobs, to keep factories from shuttering, the union said, okay, we'll do this. There was an implicit promise that when things turned around and the company was back in the black, that it would repay workers for those sacrifices. And then what happened? What we saw over the next few years was that GM just was expanding this lower paid class of workers. It was hiring more temp workers who were like a third class of worker on the shop floor. And then, you know, years later, it rewarded workers by shuttering more plants, by doing mass layoffs, and using the profits that it was making, these record profits, to, you know, pay back their shareholders, right? So this is where things are going. And I would really stress to listeners that this isn't just an issue plaguing kind of certain manufacturing or production, consumer product production industries. Everywhere is every sector of the economy is facing this sort of two-tier problem. Right now, as we speak, taxi drivers in New York City are going on a hunger strike because they have been pushed to the end of their rope. Taxi drivers have even been committing suicide because they were taken advantage of by the city that pushed a lot of these immigrant and workers of color to buy these sort of medallions that allow them to kind of own and their own taxi cabs in the city and pick up street fares and stuff like that. Now those the price for those medallions has been inflated artificially so much that a lot of these immigrant workers are saddled with like $500,000 worth of debt that they'll never repay, and they feel like they have no option but to go on a hunger strike. And the reason I bring this up is because that taxi industry has essentially been bottomed out by a second tier employment system that we call the gig economy, right? All the different ways that employers have basically found ways around hiring and maintaining and adequately paying full-time employees, that's happened in the gig economy, that's happened in manufacturing, it's happened in academia, where you've seen the rise of like adjunct teachers who are paid poverty level wages, while tenure track professors with more protections are essentially becoming extinct. This is happening everywhere. Bosses are trying to squeeze the working class for as much as it can get out of us and pay us as little as it possibly can. And I think that workers collectively have had enough of that.
Well, so again, Kellogg's reported profits of $1.25 billion last year alone. Senator Bernie Sanders tweeted support for the Kellogg's workers and says its CEO, Stephen Cahillane, makes about $12 million a year. I mean, that's the other thing here, Maximilian. We are talking about CEOs that are making obscene amounts of money, obscene profits, and yet they're trying to squeeze workers as much as possible. I want to ask you about the taxi hunger strike in a minute, because, I mean, to think that workers have to go on a hunger strike in the year 2021. But let's really talk about what's at stake here. I don't think my dad would mind if I shared this quick story, but he recently had a couple of really intense surgeries, and he was a sheet metal worker. He had an amazing union, and I am so grateful because he has Medicare, but he has an incredible supplement. And then because of the union, he has this benefits card. So anytime he has to pay out of pocket, he just uses that benefits card, and he has an amazing pension. I mean, this is a sheet metal worker. They got a $12 an hour wage in the 70s. So I do not have to worry about my dad, thankfully. But think about all of these workers right now who are going to be 70 years old in 20, 30 years? What is in store for their future? I mean, people now who are 70. My dad said the guy he shared a room with in the hospital, he has no family. He has no social safety net. He took a cab home from the hospital. How is that guy going to heal? And there's millions of people like that across this country.
Oh, yeah. No, it's the ruling class has no plan for the population because the ruling class does not care about the working population. They don't care what happens to us. And that they're making that abundantly obvious by their actions, right? I mean, you know, that story you shared really hits home because, you know, as I've talked about many times on my show and in other interviews, you know, our family lost everything in the Great Recession, including the house that I grew up in. And I grew up in Southern California, where you guys are. And, you know, my folks who had worked their butts off for years, and I truly believe they felt like they had attained the American dream and then lost it and will never get it back. You know, that trauma is never going away. That feeling of demoralization and failure is never going to truly go away. And also what comes with that is kind of the sad, somber realization that they're probably never going to retire. Mm. And when you look around and you think like, well, like what options are there to take care of these folks if they don't have a pension, right? If they don't have, you know, jobs that have allowed them to put that money away so that they can retire and live out their lives with dignity, like the vast majority of us are in that boat, right? There really is no plan for us. And so, yeah, you're going to see, you know, like folks working way past the age that they should. We live in a country where the social safety net has been vilified and gutted mercilessly for decades. And if you don't have a net, what happens? People just fall to the bottom. And that's what we are going to see. And we are actually facing quite a crisis there with that, because the boomer generation right now is the oldest currently aging generation. And it's going to be replaced by the next you know, biggest generation. And, you know, what are we going to do for them? I genuinely don't know, but it makes it all the more infuriating that you have, you know, companies like John Deere right now that is set to record a truly staggering record $5.7 billion in profit this year, coming out and trying to kind of, pay workers less and give them less for retirement, right? And that, I think, is what we're seeing that is really truly a magical thing. And it's like something we all need to invest in and support, because I think workers have been pushed for so long, taken advantage of for so long. And I think in past times, the reason that workers were more willing to accept these concessions, these cuts to their benefits, to their retirement, to the changes to the employment model, like the two-tier wage system, workers have largely accepted that because it felt like there was no other option and because it felt like this was like a necessity. You know, I mentioned the concessions that GM auto workers took in the Great Recession. That was during a recession, right? The choice that was presented to them was we either close and everyone loses their jobs, or we make these cuts, we tighten our belt, and we try to live to fight another day. That's the same situation that the UAW was in back in like 1980, when German and Japanese cars were really kind of posing a market threat to U.S. made cars. And so workers at Chrysler were kind of told to take way more concessions so that they didn't become, you know, like what Flint would become, right? So in those periods, you know, I think workers felt like, I got to hold on to what I have lest I lose everything. And it feels like we and the company are in the same boat. We have to do what we have to do to survive. So we'll make these cuts and we'll you know, accept it. What's different now, as you mentioned, is that people are seeing that we're not in the same boat. Right. Workers are in one boat. The ruling class and the bosses and the 1%, they're in their own yacht, right?
Maximilian, sorry to cut you off, but we only have 2 minutes left, and I really want to read a couple of tweets from the New York taxi workers because they have gone on hunger strike this morning. And, you know, I just hope that this news gets a lot of media coverage. So this is from the New York taxi workers. Today, we begin a hunger strike to fight for people people like our sister, Dorothy LeConte, a Haitian immigrant and driver of nearly 40 years. She owes almost $600,000 in medallion debt. We will not let the New York City mayor leave us behind while he bails out the bankers profiting from our pain. Dorothy recently told In These Times, quote, "I think about suicide," she tells me one sunny Saturday afternoon as we sat in the unfoldable chairs. "And then when I come back, I think about my children and I turn around and say, Dorothy, don't." Max, just in our final minute, as you said, tragically, cab drivers have taken their own lives and they've been protesting for 30 days. They feel that they have to take it to the next level. And so now they're on hunger strike.
It's a really, really awful situation. And I actually do have an interview with one of these hunger strikers that should be coming out later today at the Real News Network. And I would encourage everyone to follow the New York Taxi Workers Alliance to show support for these workers, because you don't understand their situation, right? If you're looking at this just like, oh, well, taxi drivers are a thing of the past. Like, no, that's something different, right? Look at how they've been taken advantage of. Look at the way the medallion system has been used to saddle them with huge amounts of debt. This is a struggle we all need to care about, and we all need to, because the stakes are incredibly high. The stakes are the lives of these workers and their families.
Well, we will definitely do a show about this in the coming days. Maximilian Alvarez is editor-in-chief of the Real News Network and host of The Working People, a podcast about the jobs, dreams, and struggles of the working class. Max, thank you so much for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Right back at you.
Thank you. You can find more information about all of these worker actions at yourcallradio.org. Also, we talked earlier about the garment workers who are for the first time going to receive an hourly wage in Los Angeles. It is $15 an hour. So instead of being paid $3 to $5 an hour, they will receive $15 an hour. And Linda sent over an email providing a list of companies that did support this bill. She says there's a conspicuous absence of companies on that list. We will put it at put this list on our website so you can find out who supported the bill and who did not. And then we also have links about the John Deere protest, the Kellogg's protest, and the Kaiser strike. They authorized a strike. And as I said, we will definitely do a show about taxi drivers who have gone on strike in New York City this morning. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Joanne Marr for engineering our show. You can find all of our past shows at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our podcast. If you use iTunes, be sure to leave us a review. And you can interact with us on Twitter @yourcallradio. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.